Good morning. My name is Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. Why you came back? I don't know if I would have. So, how many people in this room have ever got to a point where you sincerely either had a born-again experience, or you prayed fervently to God not to drink again, or you had some kind of spiritual thing happen, and after all of those things, you ended up drinking again? Anybody? So the problem, evidently, is not coming to believe in God. The problem is, how do we get closer to the power? How do we access the power? When I was new, I went to a meeting, and a guy came up to me after the meeting, and he said to me, "You need to take step three." And I said to this guy, Joe Wright, I said, "Joe, the truth is I can't take step three." And he said, "How come?" I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if there's a God or not. I don't really believe in God." And he said to me, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." I said, "Joe, that's what it kind of says. Look at the steps. It's step two, came to believe. That's before step three. I don't have that. And step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't even believe in him. I can't have any of that." And he said once again, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." And then he said, "If you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair," and he pointed to a chair in the Alano Club, the old Alano Club, he said, "I guarantee you an instantaneous miracle." And I thought, what the heck? All right, Joe, I turn my will, my life over to the chair. And he gets a big smile. He said, "The miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot." And I got it. And I didn't get offended. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Because I was already in the process of an awakening that I wasn't aware of. And the beginning of that awakening was to start to see that I was the center of the problems and be suspect of my own thinking. I remembered when I asked my sponsor to sponsor me, I said to him, I just can't trust my own judgments anymore. And he had this big smile on his face. I didn't know that in essence was a piece of the second half of step one, which is essential in order to get a new manager. Because I think a lot of us either have this coming in or it comes back later, is this idea that my life was only unmanageable when I was drinking. Now, if that was the case, you don't need the rest of the steps, because you don't need to access more other power. You don't need a new manager. And I think some of what happened to me is I came in a surrendered state. The ego came back. And I started running the show again, and I had another collapse. And as we all seem to do, as the wheels come off and we have the second and third and fourth surrender, we come here surrendered by the bottle, and then I eventually am surrendered by life itself, by an absolute failure to, as the book says, wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. And it was it's very important not only back then to have gotten the need to get my life out of the hands of this idiot, but to continually reaffirm that reality, because this gets smart, right? See, this will learn more about AA than you will, right? It'll use AA against you, right? We a lot of us have that experience. We learn the book, we learn the tradition, we learn that stuff so we can be more useful servants. No, so you can go to meetings and lord it over people, and feel smugly superior to the uninformed. You know what I mean, right? Isn't it odd that the ego could take the very actions and principles that are to be applied for its reduction and use those things for its grandizement. I mean, but the ego there's no end to its hypocrisy. It will use anything to grandize itself, to make itself up here, because that's what it wants. What's it say in the book? It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. I used to go to my sponsor in early sobriety I'm the guy who gets such emotional angst that I feel like I'm losing my mind. I'm going to have a nervous breakdown and I need help. But I always wait till it gets to that point. I need help long before that, but I don't want to look like I need help. And it's hard getting help and looking like you don't need it at the same time. It's really an art form that some of us develop here. But it's very difficult to do that. And so consequently, by the time I go to him, I got a bushel of stuff. I mean, and I dump it all on him. And I got mental lists of people that are out of line. You know, the guy selling Amway after the meetings at the Thai club, and the 13 steppers who I can't stand until my sponsor says, "You're just jealous they're getting more action than you are." Which no, it's not that. It's the principle that then, you know, when he was actually right. All the little petty judgments, and I'd get done spewing all these little judgments, and he'd say this thing would just go over my head. He'd say, he says, "You got to quit playing God." And I would think, I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. But in actuality, I was playing God. I didn't know it. But wasn't I truly setting myself apart from and above everyone else? As if I placed myself on some sort of throne of judgment, seeing what's wrong with you. As a matter of fact, seems to be one of the elements why my life's unmanageable. Because I have, Clancy says that this is a disease of perception. And my perception has certain default positions. And one of them is to only see the negative. Do you ever walk into a room of strangers and just automatically see the good in them? I don't. I walk in and look at your body language, and I don't like you, and I don't. You're not my type of person. And look, what are you judging me? What are you looking at me for? You know, I'm just that guy. I only know when you have a egocentric, fear-based perception and mentality. You only notice the things you have to defend yourself against. You don't see the good, and that's why so many alcoholics suffer from depression. So many alcoholics suffer from anxiety and worry. We see problems that don't even exist. Wilson says it best. He says, we talk a lot about problems, he says, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. He says, the reason is that we are problem people. That is my mentality. It's problem seeking. Did you ever see that movie Sixth Sense where the little kid walks around and says, "I see dead people"? The alcoholic walks around and goes, "I see problems. I see them everywhere I look. Okay, that's not a problem yet, but I can see this is going to become, I better watch you. Because I can see you're about to get weird on me any second now. And I'll position. And what I don't understand and never see, the cause and effect, is that perception alters the way I show up in my positioning in the world. What happens is I show up in such a way that I will feed the situation. And often, as psychiatrists call this, the self-fulfilling prophecies make the problem come true. And what's it say? The book says we're the producers of confusion rather than harmony. Our problems of our own making. We must, in the book, we must stop manufacturing misery. That's like a steel mill that can't make steel anymore. What do you do now? I mean, well, you turn into a casino, I guess. I don't know. That's what they did here. I mean, what? If all you've ever done was look for problems to manage, it's like that's the. What does this do? And I think that's why I'm a problem seeker, is because without problems, without things to worry about, my ego has nothing to do. It almost will sink into obscurity and diminish without it feeds off of situations mostly imagined that it can play God over. And I think that's what it wants. It wants to reign. It wants to play God. It wants to be God. I wouldn't have admitted this because it's sound. The ego is smart. The ego is egotistical, but it's smart enough to not want to look ego. It doesn't want me to appear. It wants the bragging rights of the humble. But in actuality, what was one of my problems with God is he had my job. No, I mean, really, when you think about it, I mean, listen, if someone's going to be ruler of the universe, who should it be? Let me see. Well, I don't know anybody smarter than me. I mean, right? Now that's such an egotistical position, but yet that was me. And you got to keep it on the down low because you want the bragging rights of the humble. You don't want to look egotistical. No matter how much you are. And so I got problems with running the show. I am addicted to it. As a matter of fact, I over the years, I've gotten these glimpses of myself that are hideous. That as if I am as addicted to the action of up here in the control center, being in charge and figuring and maneuvering. And I'm addicted to the action of running my life and figuring and protecting and defending and maneuvering. The ego's addicted to that. And so it's hard to let go. It's hard. And so the book spends a couple pages prior to the third step prayer, trying to hammer in the painful reality of me. And it's odd that how difficult some of this is to see. My sponsor in early sobriety had me on this kick of reading page 60 through 63 over and over and over again. And I get to the bottom of page 60, and Bill creates an amazing, insightful analogy that sort of shines a light in every single one of us. I've never met an alcoholic that isn't in this, yet most of us can't see it initially. And he starts talking about that we live by self-propulsion. That's a kind of a good analogy. I used to seem like to me I'd get sober and I'd be jacked up about turning my life around. I'm never going to drink again. And it was like a balloon that you'd blow up and then let go. I'd go like hell for a while. Yeah. And then I'd run out of gas. Yeah. And it was time to drink again. Live by self-propulsion. He says that each of us is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Now, this is not the director. This is just an actor in the company. Matter of fact, the book doesn't even really say whether this guy's even got a speaking part. So he might be the tree, you know. But he wants to run the whole show. He is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. And I would read that, and I don't get this. It's not me. But my God, I could see how it was people I worked with and people I went to meetings with. You want to really see this? Go to your home group's business meeting. And then you'll understand why your sponsor wanted you to read this, so you can see it in them. I mean, maybe point it out to them, because they need to know. And there's a line in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions where it says that we are quick to see our defects of character in others before we can see them in ourselves. I could see it when you were running the show. I couldn't see when I was doing it. And then I had that day. We all have these days, you know, when this, I'm in emotional pain and angst and it's not good. And there's something, some dynamic that I'm not sure I understand completely about when the spiritual principles and experience of Alcoholics Anonymous comes together with my emotional pain, and it opens my mind up and lifts the veil, and I can see things I couldn't see before. And I was having one of those kind of days where I think I just woke up afraid. Did you ever wake up in fear? You don't even know what you're afraid of. It's just a feeling. It's just a sense that there's some bad crap going to happen today. And so you start off on high alert, right? And I go to work on high alert, and I don't know I'm on high alert. I'm just a little off, you know, and I get to work, and I work as a clerk in a store, and it's one of those days when a couple pallets of merchandise have come in, and they all have to be priced and made. The shelves have to be arranged, have to be put up, and it's a lot of work. And there's three guys working that day, myself and these two other guys. Well, I get into the work, and I'm back there busting my butt, putting all this stuff up. Those other two idiots aren't even helping. They're up at the cash register drinking coffee and telling jokes and laughing with, playing around with the customers and stuff. And I'm watching them having, laughing and drinking coffee, and I'm back there busting my, and I'm getting aggravated with them. And then customers walk right by them and come back and ask me for help. Can't they see how hard I'm working back? Why do they have to bug me? But I help them because that's my job. And I go back to, my boss comes in. He doesn't even say, "Oh my God, Bob, look what you're doing for us." I mean, he doesn't even say it. He doesn't even notice. He's up there drinking coffee with the two idiots, right? Right? He doesn't even, not even an attaboy. Nothing. By the end of the day, I am like a spring that has been tightened and tightened and tightened. And I'm angsty because I've been noticing all day. I get off work. I'm a secretary of a meeting over at the old Alano Club. Another club. And I got to go get some stuff at the store on the way to the meeting. And I'm coming down Maryland Parkway to go, and I stop at this place and I get some styrofoam cups, and I'm in the 15 to 12 item or less aisle, and I'm getting these cups, and there's a woman there with 15 items in front of me. I counted them twice. I was really sure. Matter of fact, I hope I didn't do this, but I may have actually counted them the second time, like, I don't know. I could have done that. I just cringed to think that I may have. And I just was tightening that spring up. If I wouldn't have been in such a hurry, I would have gone back to the office. I would have pulled the manager up here, and I would have made him count them underneath the 12-item row. But I don't. Instead, I just tighten the spring up. I go get in traffic, and I'm coming down Maryland Parkway. This is one of those roads with no divider in the middle. At certain parts, there's certain parts there are, certain parts there aren't. And there's three lanes this way and three lanes that way. I'm coming down in front of the, I'm coming down this one part where there's no dividers. And I'm in a hurry. I'm meeting a new guy at this meeting, and I don't want him to get there before me, right? I got to get there before him. And I'm the secretary, and I got stuff to do, put the literature out, etc., get the right chairperson, etc. So I got to get there before this new guy. And I get behind this woman who's going, she's in the fast lane, the left lane, the lane where people are supposed to go faster, and she's going 5 miles an hour below the speed limit in the fast lane. And I'm behind her, and she's driving me crazy. And at one point I had the thought of flooring it, and I'll push us both into oncoming traffic, and we'll probably be killed, but she'll see. But I don't do anything. It's just thoughts, you know. Just I'm a puffer fish, and I just tighten that spring up a little bit more. I get to the meeting, and the new guy's there already. And you know where he's sitting? He's sitting in the back. I just get up here, sit up right. I'm not running the show. I'm serving the universal good. And I get him. I tell him where to sit, and I set the literature out, and I can set some literature out. It's impressive, really. And I wait and get the perfect, wait for the perfect chairman and co-chairman to start this meeting. The guys that are going to lay the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, these guys, I'm going to get two guys that I know are going to put on a good meeting. And I get the right guys. I said to the one guy, I said, listen, we got a new guy here. So let's not read chapter 5. Let's read chapter 3. More about alcoholism for the new guy. And he goes, oh, yeah. Good. Okay. They start the meeting. The newcomer's there. They're reading chapter 3. I'm watching him to see if he's getting it. I'm picturing him taking his year cake and mentioning my name. If it wasn't for Bob, he saved my life. Yeah, I loved it. Anyway, they get done reading chapter 3, and the chairman says, anybody have anything you want to start off with? Some guy raises his hand. I don't know who this guy is, some idiot. Starts talking about shooting heroin. Well, some other old guy who's never done drugs, didn't know anything about that, interrupts him in the middle of his share and says, you can't talk about that here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, another guy jumps in and yells at the old guy, you can't tell him what to say. He can say anything he wants. This is AA. And it's like the meeting from hell. I'm telling you. And the whole vision of the newcomer getting the cake and mentioning my name is just like fading like smoke in the wind, man. It's like, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm really angst up. Because AA is stupid. And the people are stupid. And nobody gets it. I'm the only one here that gets it. I'm the only one here that cares. And I'm just up to here with it. I'm going to quit AA. I'm tired of it. I storm out of there. I go home, and like Pavlov's dog, I've been trained to call my sponsor, and I call my sponsor, and he says, read page 60 through 63. And I get to the bottom of page 60, and it says, we're like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the customers in the store, the other employees, the people in traffic, the people in the grocery store, the people sharing in meetings in his own way. If only his arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased and life would be wonderful. And for the first time in my life, that was me. Now, this isn't like this has only been me for a week. This has been me all my life, and I couldn't see it. And it opened up vistas of understanding why I was here and why these steps are such a matter of life and death for me. Because without a surrender, without heading in the direction of self-abandonment and service and self-forgetfulness, I will always be that guy. And that guy is the producer of confusion. That guy lives in angst and conflict to the point where he can't take it anymore, and he either implodes into depression, or he, to relieve the anxiety, he takes something, or he drinks. And I'm that guy. Or if he can't take something, you can't drink, and you can't live with the emotional conflict anymore, what do? You start thinking about offing yourself, right? Because emotions just wear on you. And so I had to get my life out of the hands of this idiot. And I started to see, you know, the book says that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. It's odd that I couldn't see that, and yet it had been true all my life, that I worry about and I'm concerned with and I'm focused on basically me, my feelings, my thoughts, my finances, my sex life, my stuff. It's all about me. If I'm kind to you, it's because there's something you have I need. Maybe it's your love, maybe it's your approval, maybe it's your support, but it's all about me. It's all about me. And self-centered, people's consciousness is centered primarily on themselves. Self-absorbed, self-obsessed people like me, we go through life when we're sober and locked up in the bondage of self. We don't feel like we fit out here in the world. The world is very distant from me. And the reason it's so distant from me is I don't live out here. I live up here. I live up here in the story of the world. I live up here. Not, I don't live in my life. I live in the chatter about my life in my head, disconnected and disassociated from life itself. Alcohol, that's why alcoholism is such, when you get sober, it can be such a lonely and depressing business, this thing called abstinence. Because alcohol, at one time, freed me from the bondage of self. And I think that's the only freedom that's worth anything. See, I'm the guy, when I quit drinking, I just get myself and my emotions and my future and my shameful past. I get it all right on me. Like that creature in that movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. I just get so much of me on me that I feel like I'm smothering here. And I am. I am suffocating myself with myself. I'm smothering myself with my obsessive thoughts of myself. And every alcoholic knows the experience of being 6 months sober, 3 months sober, 3 weeks sober, and just feel like you're locked up and you're stuck inside yourself with all these feelings. And you take the first drink and we all have the same reaction. We go, like someone turned the oxygen back on. The word spirit means breath of life. And if you ever get a chance to read Carl Jung's letter to Bill Wilson in the early 60s, he says something in there I think is very profound. He says that he believed, as a result of working with Roland Hazard and countless other alcoholics, that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol is not really a thirst for alcohol. That it was a low-level thirst of my being for wholeness, unity, or a union with God. I yearn for connection. That's why, because in the backdrop of alcoholism, it's such a lonely, lonely business. I yearn to be plugged in, to be connected, to be one with, because I'm so one apart from. Wilson uses a term in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions that really resonates a lot with me. He calls it anxious apartness, because you can't settle into the loneliness. It's brutal. So there's an anxiousness about this separation, and I can't seem to overcome it. Alcohol overcame it. 5 shots of whiskey at one time before it turned on me would free me and set me up to be a part of, to connect me with people. And when it stops working, alcoholism is a horrid, horrid, lonely business. So there is only one freedom, and that's the freedom from self. Everything else comes from that. I went with a guy that I know in California. He took me to a meeting up in Central Coast. It was a Supermax up near Morro Bay. And it's a huge AA group, probably 170 members. Impressive. line of greeters out the door. I mean, service commitments. This group did hospital and institution work in the prisons by taking the big book and going into the fish tank where they bring the new guys in and reading them the doctor's opinion. They did their own corrections work in an institution. I thought that was very impressive to me. And there were lifers in there that will never get out of prison. They will never. And they're sponsoring people. And I sat there and I watched them and I listened to their laughter. And I realized that those men were freer than people I go to meetings with on the outside. Because there's only one freedom, and they found it, and they found it locked up for life in prison, and that is the freedom from the bondage of self. And some of us walk around absolutely free out here, but so locked up in here. And so this is, I am seeking in the decision in step three the same thing I sought in the bottle. And the problem is that the taking of step three doesn't solve the problem. It just points the direction. It's really, truly in my experience, the third step prayer is basically a decision to head my life in the direction of making it, first of all, none of my business. Because that's what I'm saying to God. I'm saying, God, I offer myself to you. For you to build with me now and you to do with me now as you will. But what about what I will? No. This is an abandonment of what I want. It's wanting to want what God wants. See, I don't know about you, but I've never been able to stop wanting. I got this wanter, just wants. Half the time, I don't even know what I want. What do you want, Bob? I don't know. More, different, yours. I don't know. And when I get it, it ain't it. You know, it's next. You know, next. I don't know, but I want. And so how do you, if there's no off switch, and it makes you miserable, it's constant disillusionment and dissatisfaction as the shine wears off of every acquisition. So what's the answer? It's a realignment, is to want what God wants. It's a shift. You can't shut the wanter off, but you can redirect it. The book says we must constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. It's to want what God wants. And so I say to my Father, God, I offer myself to thee for you to do with me and build with me as you will. And I'm asking him, that's so important, to relieve me of the bondage of self. Because the reality is if he doesn't give, if I don't have some sort of ego and self-reduction, how am I possibly going to make my life none of my business when it is the primary focus, perception, and concern in me? I don't know about you, but I wake up in the morning. I don't wake up worrying about you. I wake up worried about me. If I'm worried about you, it's because you have something to do with me. But I'm a self ponderer and a self. I'm self concerned, which would be all right if that brought happiness and it brought satisfaction, but it brings unhappiness and dissatisfaction. And so I have to make my life none of my business, and I can't do that, so I'm begging God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And then in the last line, if he'll take away these difficulties. What difficulties? There's only one, and it's the difficulties that come from the bondage of self. Everything we will inventory from this, then the third step on, has to do with manifestations of self. Fear, selfishness, self-seeking, self-pity, self-delusion, inconsideration, arousing, jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, everything through step four and step 10 and the 11, step 11 nightly examination all has to do with looking for the reoccurrence and the resurgence of self. Is to look for that. And so I'm asking God to take away these difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. That's That's like a contractual agreement. I'm coming to God in a helpless mode. I'm coming to God and I'm saying, I'm screwed here. I have done everything I could do. I've spent every dime I could spend. I've been to therapy. I've been everywhere. I've done everything trying to make myself better. And I'm getting worse here. I just tried to kill myself. I can't fix me. I can't. So I'm saying to God, here, take me, please. You have your way with me. And relieve me of the bondage of self. And if you'll do that, I will come out of the ashes of my life and I will devote my life to helping your kids. The decision in step three is a decision to move towards self-abandonment and service. And this is not a self-help program. It's the opposite. It's a program of self-abandonment. If self-help would have worked, we would have been fixed years ago. But it doesn't work. Sheldon.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. It's a funny deal, this step three conversation. I imagined if I was going to go to a step three workshop that I would have conversation about how someone like me could get closer to God. I didn't thought it would be some kind of a prayer meeting where we'd learn the right words to say so we could get closer to God, right? But it's not. It's this conversation about my self-obsession. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. The first time I sat in a third step meeting or workshop where we talked about what's in pages 60 through 63, I started to feel sick to my stomach. Because I would like this to be behavior I'm not doing anymore. But I'm a couple of years sober and we're going through this stuff and Bob or somebody else is reading 60 through 63 and I'm thinking to myself, my God, I did that yesterday. I got plans to do that after the meeting. I got a whole conspiracy set up for next week with that kind of behavior and that. You know, the problem for me is in this journey towards God is that I don't understand why I can't just say a prayer and get to God. It seems to me, it sounds like, and I don't know how I got this message, and maybe this is the message that works for most of humanity. Maybe this is one of the things that separates alcoholics from the rest of humanity. I don't know, because the only experience I have is the alcoholic experience. But it almost sounds like you should be able to say a quick prayer to God. God will come into your life and you'll walk in hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Our friend Bob Bazant says it sounds like you should be able to click your heels three times and end up back in Kansas, right? There's no place like home. There's no place like home. But it doesn't seem to work that way for me. I've prayed before. I may not have said the actual words of the third step prayer, but I've prayed in jailhouses. I've prayed in alleyways. I've cried myself to sleep at night begging God. If praying is the answer for me, then there is no answer because I've prayed. There has to be something else that I can do that will get me to God. There's got to be something in the way. There's got to be, the door is, it feels like it's closed. And I don't know how to get through it. I don't know how to get over this barrier. I don't want to live the way I'm living. I mean, I can see that me living the way I'm living, drinking, is ruining my life. And I've had this conversation with my sponsor, and we've talked about selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my trouble and me being locked up in my head. And I don't know if I really see it completely, but I'm starting to get glimpses of how that might be true. And I don't want to live separated from the rest of the world. But how do I get to God? How do I break through this barrier that exists between me and God? It can't be through wishing. It can't be through hoping. And I've tried the prayer. So the book says at the bottom of page 63, it says, next we launched on a course of vigorous action. Kind of one of the places that the big book gives me an idea of a timeline of how I'm supposed to do Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I mean, they said when I first came in here, I don't know if you guys ever heard this, they said when I first came in here, slow is real. Right? So, I know. Some people would say, you should do one step a year. Boy, that was one of my first resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 30 days sober when I did my fifth step. It took me a while to learn I was supposed to be 5 years sober at that point. But it says, next we launched, and that gives you an idea of the pace at which Bill had this in mind, because you can't really launch slowly, right? I mean, you get done with your third step and you launch slowly. What's the slowest launch that you can have, you know? 10, 9, 8. I mean, that would be a slow launch, right? Next we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. And I had never attempted a personal house cleaning. I had attempted an everybody else house cleaning. Right? I knew what everybody else was doing wrong, what everybody else should do, how you should behave, what you shouldn't have done, what you should think, whether or not you're a good person or a bad person, whether or not you deserve all the blessings in your life, or whether they were misdirected at you instead of where they rightfully belonged, which was me, right? But I'd never done a personal house cleaning. You know, it's a funny thing. I watched my wife. I have a very good friend of mine, a guy called Corey. Corey is like a brother to me. He's a guy that I got high with for 12 years, and then I got sober. A couple years later, he got sober. And we've been sober together. I'm sober 18, he's sober 16. We've spent most of our lives together, drunk or sober, and he's really like family. Corey lives about 300 miles from us, and he doesn't come into town very often. And when he comes into town, it's not usually a planned trip. It's not usually where he can say, hey, I'm coming to town, I'm going to come see you, and we know he's coming. Because on business, he comes in and out of town. So usually when he's in town visiting, it's fast notification. Hey, I'm about half an hour away. I'd like to come over to visit. So one time he calls the house and he says, hey, I'm about 30 minutes away. I'd like to come over and visit with you guys. And I tell my wife, hey, honey, guess what? Corey's here, right? She freaks out. Now, I don't know why she freaks out, because she loves Corey. Corey stood up for me at our wedding. This is family. She should be excited that Corey's coming. But she goes in a tizzy, and she wants me to clean the house. She wants me to do a house cleaning. And I don't know why she wants me to do a house cleaning, because Corey is family. This is like one of my best friends. I tell honey, Corey don't care if the house is dirty. And we start getting in this argument, this fight. She's like, would you leave me alone? Just stop it. Just go do the dishes. You do the dishes, I'll vacuum. Put that stuff away. What are your shoes doing on the living room here? What the hell is wrong with you? My God, I'm forever spending my life picking up after you, right? And she goes in, and I'm like freaking out. It's just Corey. She takes a deep breath and she says to me, you don't understand, do you? She says, I don't want to clean the house because Corey's coming. I want to clean the house because when Corey gets here, Corey won't care if the house is dirty. But when Corey gets here, if the house is a mess, I will sit uncomfortably while Corey's here, wondering if Corey is judging me, even though I know he isn't. I'll notice the mess on the floor and I'll feel ashamed and I'll feel uncomfortable because the mess is on the floor. The dishes will be in the sink and I'll feel bad because I'm the kind of person that has dishes in the sink when we have company. And I tell you, a funny thing happens. Every time I tell this story, the guys are looking at me confused. And the women are doing this. The women are going, yeah, that's how it would be. She says, I don't want to clean the house because Corey cares if the house is dirty. I want to clean the house because I won't be comfortable with Corey in the house if the house is dirty. And something clicked inside me for the first time in my life. I didn't really realize why it was that we did inventory and house cleaning in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I got to tell you, God doesn't care if the house is dirty. God doesn't care if I've got some resentments. God doesn't care if I have some fears. God, quite frankly, doesn't care about my sexual inventory. I don't believe, and I think that this is absolutely true, I don't believe that there's anything that I can do in this world, anything I can do that'll make God not love me as much as he loves me right now. Now, I don't believe that there's anything that I can do, anything at all in this world that I can do that'll make God love me more than he loves me right now. I think God just loves me. But I'm blocked from God because I'm not comfortable letting God into my life when the house is a mess. God will come anyway. In fact, the truth is God is there anyway. But I won't recognize him, embrace him, or let him in my life in the way that is necessary unless I clean house. So I have to do this house cleaning. Though our decision was vital and crucial, it was an incredibly important decision, this step three decision to turn my will and my life over to God. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in our life which have been blocking us. What I suspected is true. I'm blocked from God. I'm blocked from God from all these fears and these concerns and this judgment and this idea of how I think the world should be and this insistence that the world should be the way that I envisage it should be. This guilt and this shame and all the things, all the anger and the resentment. So I do this inventory. And this inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. I'm going to discover things about me that I didn't know were true before. And what are those things? Maybe you had the same experience I had. My sponsor sits with me in this 60 through 63 conversation, in this third step conversation, and he tells me I'm selfish and self-centered. And I want to argue that because I don't really think I'm selfish at all. I'm the guy that if you come to my house and there are three beers left, I'll give you one. That's not selfish. That's not selfish. You know, I give people rides to meetings. I bought a newcomer a hamburger just the other day. I'm not selfish. In fact, honestly, I spend most of my life trying to make people happy. And so he points out to me, you're not very good at it, are you? How many people are happy? But I can't see that I'm selfish. When I did that 60 through 63 work with my sponsor, I think the reason he told me to read it over and over and over again is because I can't really see the bondage of self. And I think if I could see it, if I could see it in a real way, maybe I wouldn't need to do the rest of the steps. But what am I going to do now when I write this inventory and do this work is I'm going to take a look at some actual areas of my life where I have been self-obsessed, where I have been selfish. I'm going to look at some real examples of where in me I have been driven by this stuff. Bottom of the page it says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we've not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. First time I heard that spiritually sick thing, kind of bothered me a little bit. Because it sounds kind of, I don't know, religious a little bit, right? I'm spiritually sick, like, ooh. Like we're going to kill some chickens or something. I don't know what I thought it meant. But I was given a description of spiritually sick that made sense to me, where I could see where I was mentally ill. I could see where I was crazy. I could see that nobody that lived the way that I lived and continued to do the things that I could do would be of sound mind. And I knew that I was physically ill. I mean, even in its most basic sense, that I had not taken care of myself, that I had suffered with hangovers. But this idea that when I take a drink, that there is something different about me, this phenomenon of craving, I'm starting to see that in my life, that physically there is something different about me. But this idea that I am spiritually ill, I struggle with. And then it was described to me this way, and it just, the lights came on for me a little bit. Because I don't really see myself the way you see me. When you look at me and when I look at you, we see people, we see whole human beings. But I don't feel like a whole human being the way I experience myself. It's almost like I experience myself as a body separate from my mind. It's almost like when I experience myself that this is a body that I control and I live inside my head. I'm like a guy inside my brain controlling a body with levers. It's almost like I am separate and apart from. Like I know that there is a life force, there is something that is of me and is me but is separate from me. And that thing inside me is sickened. That spirit inside me, that life force, that thing that I think that isn't really physically me, is sickened. And I can buy that I have a spirit sickness or a spiritual sickness. And I have all three of those things wrong with me. The book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically as if somehow, if we could fix that spirit, the other things would come along. That underlying the mental and the physical illness is this spiritual malady, is this illness of the spirit. And if the spirit could be revitalized, if that thing could be fixed, then the other two things would come along. And I saw a movie. There's a movie, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie What the Bleep. It's a great movie. There's a great part in that movie about a guy called Dr. Emoto. Now, Dr. Emoto is not conference approved. but he does this scientific experiment that I think was marvelous. It really meant a lot to me. What Dr. Emoto did was he went to a river in Japan, a very spiritual river in Japan, a river they believe has a lot of power. And he took some water from this river and he put it in beakers. And in one of the beakers, he wrote the symbol for what he called the chi of love. Now, I don't know what that is, but apparently it's this very nice spiritual thing. And he wrote that and he put it on the beaker. And then he put hate on this other beaker. And then you get groups of people prayed beautiful things at the one beaker of water. And then they insulted the other beaker of water. And then they took this water and they flash-freezed it in a flash-freeze thing that scientists might use. Because that scientists have flash-freezy things. And it's one of the toys you get when you go in the laboratory. It's like a ray gun, I think, that you shoot at them. I'm not sure how it works. I want one. I know I want one. And then they cut slivers off the ice and they put it under electron microscopes. And what they discovered was amazing. They discovered that when you looked at the ice that had been insulted and that it had hate directed at it, that the ice crystals that formed were broken and jagged and ugly. And the ice crystals that it had the chi of love on them and the prayers of love had been directed at were beautiful and pretty and just, they were just divine. And in this movie has a storyline. There's a guy that's looking at this ice, and there's a girl that's looking at this ice, and they don't know each other. And the guy starts talking to the girl. She's kind of cute. I assume he's hitting on her. It's the only reason I could think of that he was talking to her. But he starts talking to her about these pictures that they have of this ice. And he says the strangest thing. He says, if thoughts can do and words can do that to water, what might it do to us if we are 80% water? And I got thinking, now I'm kind of a cynical guy. So I tell you this beautiful story, and I don't know how true it is, right? I don't know if the ice crystals look pretty in one beaker or they don't look pretty in the other beaker. But the idea that the way that we think and the way that we look at the world and our perception of the universe could sicken my spirit made me think that maybe that's why I have to do this inventory for me to get through to God. Because there's so much poison inside me of the way I look at the world and this angst and this anxious apartment and this loneliness and this fear and the things that I'm driven by. Maybe there's so much of that inside me that I couldn't possibly get to God if I tried. And maybe what I need to do to get closer to God is find a way to remove the blockage. And maybe if I remove the blockage, God will just come right in. Maybe if I remove the blockage, God will just come right in. So what do I do? How do I get from here to there? How do I do that? And there are clear-cut directions on 64, 65, and 66 to show me exactly how to remove the blockage. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a glimpse into some of the things that happened with me when I did my inventory. First of all, if you have never written an inventory and you're afraid to write the inventory and you're new, I have to tell you that we could write your inventory for you. Because they're all the same. Right? First name on the list is mom. Second name on the list is dad. Third name on the list is your current spouse. Fourth name on the list is your current employer. Then you got your siblings. Then you've got your previous spouse, previous employer, previous spouse, previous employer, previous spouse. And then you got all your uncles and aunts and everybody basically that's had any meaningless contact with you in your entire pathetic little life. Going all the way back as far as you can remember, right? So it's not a difficult list to write because all of our lists look exactly the same. So it says here that we in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So I took out the sheet of paper and I wrote down on the list my dad and my mom and all the other names. And then it says the next thing that we're going to do is we're going to write what happened. What did they do? We listed the institution's principal here. We asked ourselves why we were angry. My dad left when I was 2 years old. And when my dad left, my life changed. When my dad left, when I was 2 years old, we were living in a nice upper middle class neighborhood in a Jewish area. And when he left, we moved to a non-Jewish area with a lot of prejudice. It was Section 8 housing. We became a welfare kid. And I hated my dad. I mean, I just hated my dad. He completely ruined my life when he left. So I hated my dad, and then what was affected? Everything was affected. I mean, you take that little kid out of that neighborhood, put him in that situation, and the entire list on the top of 65 was affected. My self-esteem was affected. I went from thinking that I grew up thinking I didn't fit, I didn't belong. There was something wrong with me. I thought that maybe I caused the divorce. I was the youngest kid. You know, they were happily married when my brother was born. I showed up, and I must have been an awful kid because I ruined the marriage. You know, my security, we went from a nice neighborhood to a not nice neighborhood. I went from a comfortable home to a one-parent family and a lot of loss of security, ambition. I'm not getting my own way. personal relationships are affected, sexual relationships are affected. Everything in my life was turned upside down, and I hated my dad. And I hated my mom. I had the same thing going on with my mom. I hate my mom. You know, my mom just she would scream and yell a lot. I would come home from school, and it didn't really matter if my behavior was good behavior or bad behavior. She would scream sometimes and not scream other times. There's a little assumption there on my part, because what the truth is that if I had bad behavior, sometimes she would scream and sometimes she wouldn't. I never really had any good behavior, so I'm not sure how she would act with a good behavior. I'm guessing that it would have been the same way. My mom was full of panic attacks, and she was very difficult to live with, and she'd cry a lot. And sometimes I'd catch her, she'd yell at me, you know, God, you're just like your goddamn father, you know, and that was on my, the confidence of a young man. And then other times I'd catch her, she'd be crying. I said, what's wrong, Mom? It's, oh, the way I treat you kids, it's just terrible. And it was just a difficult, this is where you go, ah, oh, ready? It was, thank you. I've been trying to get my sponsor to do that for years, but he bumped, sat there like this. But it was just very difficult growing up, but I got this resentment against my mom, and I got this resentment against my dad. And the way my sponsor had me do my inventory was that he had me come to him with the first three columns, and we were going to do the last three activities or the last three columns together. Typically with guys that I sponsor, if they've been around AA for a while, I'll have them do the whole thing on their own, because it's great to see if they can get that work done on their own. But with a new guy, I like to walk him through the process the way that it was done for me. So I show up to my sponsor's house with a list that looks very similar to the example on 65. I'm resentful at why I'm resentful and what's affected. The book says to conclude that others were wrong was as far as any of us ever got. And it's so true. I had done inventory. I laid awake at night thinking about what my mom and my dad had done, what my uncles were like, my brother, my bosses, the girls that had rejected me. I had laid awake at night and inventoried all their behavior and figured out how screwed up they were. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and the more we tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. I lay in bed at night or in the morning or drift off during the day, and I'm thinking about the world, the way the world treats me, and I get sicker and sicker and sicker. I either get more restless, irritable, or discontent, more alone and more afraid in the universe, or I get so locked up that eventually I drink again. But either way, I get driven into one of those two, I can't stand being sober or I go drink again situations. When I look at this list, it becomes obvious that any life that includes deep resentment includes futility and unhappiness to the precise extent that we permit these to be scum of the hours that might have been worthwhile. But to the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. It'll kill you. It'll send you to your grave. It is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal. Fatal, another great word for death. It is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again, and with us, to drink is to die. Bill finally uses the die word. So it's infinitely grave. It's fatal. We're going to die. If we can't somehow clear away this blockage between me and God, my chances of staying sober are diminished and are nothing. I got to find a way to live in this world. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They were the dubious luxury of normal men. For an alcoholic, these things are poison. This way that I look at the world, this perception that I have of the world, has to change. There has to be a way that I can quiet the separation and the noise in my head to where I can somehow get connected with the universe, get connected with you, get connected with my fellows, and ultimately get connected with God. And if I'm unable to find a way to do that, I'm going to die. I'm going to drink again. I'm going to continue to live my life in depression and misery and thoughts of suicide and loneliness until I drink again. My sponsor's been talking to me about selfishness and self-centeredness. Been talking to me about how I want to wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world by only managing well. About how I bump up against people in the universe. About how I'm the actor that wants to run the whole show. And I only admit that I'm wrong when I'm sure others are more to blame. You know, I'm the guy that says, you know I shouldn't have stole from you, boss. I shouldn't have. But, you know, you've been paying those guys more an hour than you've been paying me. I only wanted to make it fair. I know I shouldn't have hit you. I know I shouldn't have hit you. But if you hadn't opened your goddamn mouth. I know I shouldn't have cheated on you. I know I shouldn't have cheated on you. You know, honey, I shouldn't have done that. But if you'd have given it up more often, I would. Whatever it might be, right? Whatever it might be, I'm the guy that has the excuse and the justification and the rationalization for everything. And I'm uncomfortable in the world and I'm bumping up against everybody and I'm causing friction. I'm this producer of confusion rather than harmony. But I got all these emotions tied up around everything in my life. I look at every situation in my life, every relationship in my life, and it just feels like everybody has let me down. I should be afraid and alone in this universe because every relationship that I've ever had, I feel like they've let me down or they've hurt me or they've somehow put me in a position where I feel like I'm being attacked and I have to defend and I've got these walls built up. It's no wonder I feel separate and lonely from the universe. I have these walls built up between me and them. And I show up at my sponsor's house and I hate my dad and I hate my mom and I hate every, And the bottom of 66 says, this was our cause. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. They, like ourselves, were sick too. I hate my dad. And my sponsor starts to talk to me about my dad. And, you know, he starts doing all the stuff that sponsors do because he wants me to let my dad off the hook. And he whips up my old favorite. He says, you know, your dad was probably doing the best for you that he could with the tools he had at his disposal. I'm thinking, get new tools, for God's sakes. I'm freaking 2 years old when he left. I mean, I got nothing to do with that. He's the one that wanted to have kids. And God damn it, when he left, you know, he didn't only leave and move down the street, round the corner, two towns over. My dad, when he left our hometown of Leeds in England. He moved to London. By the time I was 3.5 years old, he moved from London to Toronto. When I was 6 years old, he was living in Southern California. He moved 6,000 miles away, and he would say to me, you know, Sheldon, I didn't leave you kids. I just left your mom. And I would say, well, you know, your kids don't live in Southern California, Dad. So it seems to me like you just might have left your kids, too. I hated this guy. He never showed up. He was never there. I'm just, And we just kind of went around on my dad, and I couldn't give my dad, I couldn't let him off the hook. So we just skipped him, and we went to my mom. And he said, what about your mom, Sheldon? I said, well, you know, she's angry and she yells a lot. And I just don't trust her and I don't like her. And she made my life miserable and she'd scream and yell. And he said, when we talked about this section of the book, this was our cause. He says, do you think your mom, this was our cause. We realized the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Do you think it's possible that your mom's spiritually sick? Though you didn't like her symptoms, and I didn't like her symptoms. I didn't like her symptoms one bit. The way they disturbed me. I didn't like the way her symptoms made me feel. That they, like ourselves, were sick too. That my mom, if I was in her shoes, if what had happened to my mom had happened to me, if I had tried to raise two young kids, at a time in the north of England in a small Jewish community where it was not popular to be divorced, 1970, in that small Jewish community, we were one of two or three families that were divorced. It was a big taboo. And she's trying to raise these kids and trying to keep it together. And what would it have been like for me if I was in her shoes? If I was my mom, could I have acted and reacted the way that she did? Have I ever been so uncomfortable and so afraid that I've treated people in ways that I regretted? My mom also spent some time in Al-Anon, and there's some Al-Anons here, and I have to tell you, I'm so grateful to the Al-Anons because of the work that you guys did with my mom and the help you gave my mom. And she has become a different person in Al-Anon today through the work she did in the 12 steps of Al-Anon. But that to put myself in her shoes and to imagine what it might have been like to be her was something I had never done. There's a great line a few sentences back in the Big Book where it says, looking at these things from an entirely different angle. The only angle that I had ever looked at anything in this universe was the angle of how it affected me. I had never imagined what my childhood was like for my mom. Never even thought about it. Never anything I considered. Never considered what life was like for any of these other people. We started to talk about what it might have been like to be my mom, and could I have behaved the way my mom had behaved? Could I have seen myself reacting to that situation the way my mom reacted? And I didn't immediately fall back in love with my mom, but some cracks started to appear in the wall between her and I. We asked God to help us show him the same tolerance, patience, and pity we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful? God, save us from being angry. Thy will be done. I got to begin to get a new attitude towards my mom. A new attitude that we'll talk about more in the ninth step, that through the amends process, the relationship between me and my mom has been healed. And I'm starting to feel really good because I can see what it was like to be my mom. And I get a little tear in my eye because I can start to imagine that perhaps my mom and I can build a relationship on this foundation that's being created here. And then he says to me, what about your dad? Well, that's dirty pool. That's what that is. Because I don't want to talk about my dad. We've already talked about my dad. My dad's a jerk. There's nothing to say about my dad. He says, well, do you think that your mom got that sickness, that spiritual sickness that we're going to forgive her for? Do you think that your mom may have been that way when your mom and dad got married, or did that all develop after he left? Well, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Well, I don't know. Well, you must know because you have all this angst towards your dad. You're so certain that your dad's a bad guy. I mean, you're acting like a guy that really knows the situation. Is it possible that you don't know? Well, I mean, I suppose it's possible that I don't know. Is it possible that your mom, and you have to understand that we don't know if this story is true. We do not know if this story is true, but we're not 100% sure. We're only 95% sure now that your story is true. The one of the evil man that ran off and ruined your life. We're 95% sure of that story. Is it possible that this other story happened and we're going to play a game of pretend? Is it possible that your dad met your mom in the late 60s in a small Jewish community in the north of England when there was still conscription from the Second World War and your dad was about to go off into the Air Force? Is it true that they met very young and married very quickly? Is it possible that when your dad came back from the Air Force and they got married and they moved in together and they were two young kids that really didn't know much about life and didn't really know much about each other, ended up married together and ended up very quickly having a, her getting pregnant and having your older brother? Is it possible that your dad's in this marriage and is in this marriage? He sees that your mom struggles from panic disorder and he sees that she struggles from some of the pre-Al-Anon stuff that eventually drove her into the arms of the Al-Anon. But that your mom was a difficult person for him to live with, and they didn't get along together, and their personalities were tough. And he might have left, but the pressure of that small Jewish community made him stay there, and then she got pregnant with your older brother. And so he committed to stay, and he stayed as long as he could. And he stayed as long as he could, and he would have left, you know, when your brother was 2 years old and getting out of diapers, and at the age where she may have been able to take care of him by herself. He was going to leave, and he would have sent money, but he was going to do, but he couldn't because she ended up getting pregnant with you. And he found himself in a house with a four-year-old and a two-year-old, and a woman that he couldn't get along with, and afraid, and watching his life be this difficult and uncomfortable life, unable to get happiness. What would you have done, Sheldon, if you were in your dad's shoes? It's not fair, is it? This is not fair. I had to come home from the Air Force, realized I made a horrible mistake, gone to the bar, come home from the bar. She would have said, I'm pregnant. I would have said, good luck, and run for the hills. Now, how do I know that's true? Because when I was 16 years old, the earliest possible time in England that you can leave your parents' home, you go down to the government office, sign some papers, become an emancipated adult, they put you on welfare, you get your own place. The minute that I turned 16, I went down and I did that because I couldn't stand to live in that house with that crazy woman anymore. How do I know I would have done what my dad did? I did what my dad did the earliest possible moment that I possibly could have. I would have been living with her in his situation if that second story is true, and I would have run for the hills as fast as I could. Is it possible that your dad found himself in that situation, and instead of leaving and staying in that same small town where he grew up and all his friends were, and his mother and his father and his two brothers and his family and his community. Is it possible that he knew that if he stayed in that small town, in order to defend his honor, he would have to talk about how your mom was to live with? So the only way that she could maintain her honor is if he left the only family he knew to never live in the same town as his parents again until after his parents died. Is it possible that the very best thing he could do in an incredibly difficult situation to care about all the players involved was to move to another town so your mom could raise you boys with honor? Is it possible? I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know. It's as possible as the story that I wrote. You know what the problem with me is? Is that I get 10% of the information, 20% of the information, maybe 50% of the information, and then I go into the story writing business. And I invent the rest of the information. I have never in my life ever had all of the facts. I don't need them. I just need enough of them to write a good story. And when I write stories, I don't write love stories. I don't write happy endings. I write horror movies. And then they jumped out from behind the tree and stabbed me 34 times. I mean, it just gets worse. I never write. I write depressing novels about people that commit suicide. I'm just not a happy story writer. So when I get half the information and write the rest of the story, it's always about how bad you are. And how wrong you are, and how unfair you are. I had no idea if the second story that my sponsor wrote was true. But I knew that it was possible. It put enough of a crack in the wall for me to have a relationship with my dad, for me to have a relationship with my mom. It put enough of a crack in the wall for me in future when I looked at situations to ask myself the important question that hopefully I learn in This Was Our Calls, which is that I'm often wrong. Is it possible that the things that I think about the people that are doing the things to me that I think they're doing, they're not really doing those things at all? That when Wilson writes, are resentments fancied or real? He knows that most of them are made up. Most of the things I think happened never really happened. But why does he choose the word fancied? Because I take a position of I'm better than when I write the rest of the story. The biggest lie that I've ever told. I could never do that. I would never do that. I'm not capable of that. I had an experience with hearing a guy's fifth step at this part of the book, and it affected me in a very big way. I got a guy at my house, and at the time my son was probably 2 years old, and he starts to tell me about some of the things that he has done in his life. And he started to tell me that, not that he was abused as a child, but that he was an abusor, that he was someone that had done the acts. And I got a 2-year-old son. And I'm getting crazy as he's telling me this stuff. And I can't take it. And I want to help the guy, and I want to do the best I can for the guy, but I can't take this conversation with this guy, because the more he talks, the more I just want to kill the son of a bitch, because he's talking about things that to me, At a cellular level, I'm just so angry about. And I got this kid in the other bedroom, and I swear to you, I'd never do anything like this guy had done. And I'm just so angry, and but I gotta be nice to the guy. And I found a way to cut short our session. I made up a story about how, you know, boy, we're gonna have to pick this up at another time. And I got the guy out of my house. And I called my sponsor, and we talked about it. And he said the strangest thing. He said, have you ever done anything in your drinking that you swore you'd never do? Have you ever crossed any lines that you swore you'd never cross? I said, well, of course. He said, then I want you to go home tonight, and I want you to thank God that your obsession is for drugs and alcohol only. And that if you had an obsession like this guy had for something that to you is as abhorrent as it is, if you had the same obsession for drugs and alcohol that this guy had, what behavior wouldn't you be capable of? What lines wouldn't you cross? And I tell you, it didn't allow me to really connect with this guy. I had something inside me that really, I think, prevented me from helping this guy. But it helped me see the most important thing I think that I could see at this juncture, is that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that I'm not capable of. Afraid enough, frightened enough, driven enough, with enough obsession, there is nothing that I'm not capable of. No imaginary line that I've drawn that I'm not capable of crossing. That I'm capable of doing all of it. I'm capable of doing all of it twice. And in this part of the book, I start to see something that I hadn't been able to see before. You know, I'm separate, and I'm apart from, and I'm alone in this world because of the judgments and the ideas and the thoughts about you and about me and the way the world should be that I have created. When I meet someone and I walk into a room and I look at someone, what I do is I judge them and I say to myself, am I better than them or am I worse than them? If you're better than me, I know how to treat you. If you're worse than me, I know how to treat you. What I've never, ever, ever, ever done is I've never walked into a room and looked around and seen that I'm the same as you. And it is in finding that I am the same as you that I am able to find myself as someone that can go to God and feel God in my life. It is in the unity with you that I find God. What's that old poem? I sought my God and he eluded me. I sought myself and I couldn't see. I sought my brother and there I found all three. It was by becoming the same as you and realizing that all the heinous things I thought you had done and all the things that, all the crimes against Sheldon that had been committed, that not only were they not heinous, not only were they not against me, not only was it just you being driven by your humanity, but me in the same shoes, in the same place, driven by the same things, I'm likely to behave the same way. And coming out of my fifth step, it's not the case that I was immediately in the arms of my mommy and daddy again. But there were enough cracks in the wall created that the bulldozer of step nine were able to demolish. And I was able to have the best relationship with my parents I was ever able to have. And in that relationship and through that relationship and because of that relationship, I was able to move closer to God. Let's take a break till 10:30.